what your question is, Jim.
Okay, do you have any suggestions for someone who is in the West in America and is kind of interested in practicing as a Buddhist layman as to some of the ways that they might practice well, including the practice of sila and including the area of sex?
Yeah. But I can certainly suggest things. I mean, will a person do it? And how many people are prepared to put up with the difficulties? And, I mean, the thing is, the trouble is that when people have to apply restraint to themselves, they don't like it. It's unpleasant. Because their pleasures are bound up with sensual desires all the time. And when their pleasures are bound up with sensual desires, the tendency is to see any restriction as being something unnecessary, unpleasant. They say, why the heck should we do this? What for? And they don't see the results of it, because the results are not necessarily immediate. They come later on. And but the results are very important. The main thing is, before saying what one should do, one should have some reason why one's going to do it. And frankly, with sila, with morality, most people in the West don't seem to have any idea why they should be moral. The point is, in the West, people have been brought up with the idea that there's some God up there who is looking down on us and writing things down in his black book, everything we do bad or good or whatever it is in his black book. And then when we die, he's going to come along and we're for it. Just like a judge in court. I mean, this is not the real view of Christianity, I know. The real Christianity is something much deeper than this. But this is the popular concept people have in mind. And even if they realize that this is rather naive, at the same time, it's still lurking there, rather like a childhood concept which they've never bothered to get rid of or change. So this is what the way they think, in one way or another. But of course, if there was a God up there writing something down in black book, you might be able to evade him. If you're skillful, you might be able to do it when he wasn't looking or something. But the trouble with morality is you can't evade it. Because it's not a God up there who writes it down in the black book, it's a book, it's yourself who writes it down. And the one person who always knows about it is yourself. And whatever you do, you know, it goes into you, and it lurks there. It goes in as a cause. And later on, in one way or another, that cause is going to bring a result up. And that result is going to come up at the most awkward time, usually. And people, if it's a bad thing anyway, and people who do immoral things, they're sort of loading themselves up. And it's they who load themselves up. It's no one else that brings the trouble back to them. It's from themselves that it comes. For example, one way you can see it operating, obviously. If a person does bad actions, evil actions, very frequently, the doing of these actions changes their character. This is because of the actions they've done, the things that they do. Their character changes. I mean, you get somebody who's always killing animals, you see what they're like. They're dull, stupid people. You don't find clever people doing that. And so it is with the other immoral thing. I mean, people go on taking drugs a lot of the time. Look at them. They're just deadbeat, these people. And when a person's deadbeat like that, or dull or stupid like that, what result are you going to get from that? The result's going to be something bad. It's unpleasant. In that stupidity, there's a lot of suffering. And they themselves suffer because of what they've done. In other words, morality, or true morality, is a practice which maintains one's human status, or a proper human status. And that's all. It maintains it because one keeps one's actions within the bounds of what's going to bring reasonable results in the future to oneself. If you keep doing things which are going to bring bad results to yourself, you're just going to go down and down and down. And the more you go down, the more stupid you get, the more dull, the less you're able to see the fault you're in. And so you do more bad action. You go down and down until the end result is pretty bad, very bad. People don't see it. They don't know what it comes to. But I mean, one of the results they come to, you just go into any mental hospital and have a look around. You go and look at the really burnt out cases and see what they're like. This is the sort of thing that can come about from it. So this is the reason why one should be moral. Just to keep oneself sane. It's a sort of it's a mental hygiene. I mean, you don't go out eating things that are filthy and getting yourself absolutely dirty and filthy all the time without having a wash at any time. This isn't the way of people, not in the West anyway now. Because they're afraid. They're afraid of disease. These are diseases of the body. But they don't care a damn about diseases of the mind. And most people have got diseases of the mind right lurking in them now. And these diseases of the mind come from sort of bad states of morality more than anything else. So one should have morality. Now, as to what you should do, well, there are the standard five sila, as we call them, five precepts of Buddhism, which are very good, to train oneself not to kill. This doesn't mean just human beings, it means animals as well. Not to steal, not to indulge in any wrong forms of sex, not to use bad language, false speech, lies, slander, gossip, and so on, and not to take drinks and drugs. This is the training, and this is the thing which is really the basis of the human being. These five rules of training. If you can't even keep these, you become less and less human. And the end result, well, I'll leave it to you to guess.
What specifically constitutes wrong sex?
We can say, if you look at the general norms of sex, as they've been built up over many, over hundreds of years in society, that the things that go against those are wrong sex. It's a rough guide, but I think most people have got a fair idea what it means. It means you don't go sleeping about all over the place. It means you tend to keep to one partner, and the partners agree to together. Now, in Buddhism, Buddhism is not like Christianity, where we have marriage and so on. Buddhism has nothing to do with marriage, as you know. And the thing is, the question of sex is much more open. As far as in Buddhism, as far as we're concerned here, if a man and a woman agree to live together and to keep house together, they're married. Whether they actually have a ticket or not, that's just a legal matter. But as far as Buddhism is concerned, they're married, those people are. And they're married unless they break it up. Well, they should try not to break it up. As far as the other forms of sex, all I can say is I would advise people to be very cautious. They can lead to a lot of damage and a lot of harm. And sex is something that is very important in morality. Something which in the West people don't see the results of. The results are there, rather, and they see them, but they don't realize where it comes from. They don't see, they can't link the causes and the effects. They don't see the effects that come from bad sex or wrong forms of sex. And because of this, they don't see any reason why they shouldn't do it.
You mentioned before that a couple living together in Buddhism is considered the same as being married. Now, in the West, there are a lot of people who are living together. Now, in a situation like that, either those partners sleeping with another person or another person sleeping with one of those, that would constitute adultery or wrong sex in Buddhism then, would you say?
I would say yes, yes.
Perhaps we're getting a little ahead of ourselves by taking the morality first. Perhaps maybe you could give a general introduction to Buddhism, a general basic view of Buddhism for someone who has had no exposure. In other words, the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, what Buddhism is.
Really, the Four Noble Truths are almost the end result, but still. The thing is, when you look at life, you've got to ask yourself, what are our problems? What is the main problem that we have in life? What is the thing which we're always trying to aim for? What is our purpose, our goal? And by and large, you can say that the goal is, in practically all cases, that of attaining happiness, some contentment. Now, this points to the trouble, the fault, the thing that's always wrong, and that is discontent. And in fact, everybody is discontented. They're discontented at little things, big things, all the time. If there's nothing to be discontented with, they find something to be discontented with. Always they're discontented. I use this rather than the usual translation of dukkha, which is suffering, because discontent brings in English a much wider and better understanding of the nature of dukkha. All the time, from moment to moment, from hour to hour, from day to day, we've always got discontent. And the thing we want is happiness, which is contentment. So this is really our problem. In fact, it's our motive. Whatever we do it because we think it's going to bring us more happiness than if we don't do. Now, if we were very wise, and we could see the ways of cause and effect, and we knew them very well, then we would do those things which brought us true happiness. And we'd get it. The trouble is, though, that we've got a lot of ignorance in us, a lot of stupidity. And because of this, we always do the wrong things. We do causes that don't bring us happiness, they bring us suffering all the time, bring us discontent. So we're always putting ourselves into the same trouble that we're trying to get out of. You can see this in the newspapers, any paper you can pick up. Just look at it and look through the front page. You find endless instances there of people who think they're doing things that are going to bring them happiness. They don't. They go right the opposite direction. They just bring discontent the whole time. In Buddhism, it said the cause of this discontent, or the basis of this discontent, is always wanting, craving. We crave for things. We want this, we want that. We're always wanting things. We're always wanting them because we feel deficient. We feel we're lacking. When we feel we're lacking, we want things. And then we have to work damn hard to get them. Often it costs a lot of money, and we spend years paying back credit, I don't know what they call it now.
Mortgage,
yeah. But people always want things, they're always wanting. I mean, even when they get those things, okay, it's nice for a short while, then they lose interest, and they want something else, or they want something better, the same sort. A person wants a car, they get a car. After a while, they look on it, and they think, oh, it's just a very ordinary car, I'd much rather have a better one, I'd much rather have a bigger one, or a better one, something like that. So it goes on and on and on. All the time, they've got this craving going. This craving is bound up with discontent the whole time. Because when one craves, one's deficient, or one feels one's deficient. And one thinks the thing that one craves will sort of make up this deficiency, make one whole, make one complete. But it doesn't. Because that thing that one wants is outside, it's external. Whereas the deficiency is in oneself. And that thing that's outside remains outside, whether one gets it or not. I mean, to call oneself the owner of a thing doesn't really make it any more one's own. All it means is one's got a bit of control over it. But it doesn't sort of internally belong to one. It isn't part of oneself. It still remains separate. Because of that, it's never really satisfactory getting these goods, these position, status, whatever you want in the world. So, in Buddhism we say, the underlying causes, or the underlying basis of this discontent, is this craving all the time. And this craving arises because of ignorance. We don't understand, we don't know. We don't know the way cause and effect works. We don't know the way things are in the world. We're very clever at science. We know a terrific amount about the ways of the world. But when it comes to ourselves, we're absolutely ignorant. The person doesn't know about themselves at all. And they don't even like looking, because they might find things which will show them that they're not as good as they think they are. So they keep their mind outside in the world, and they're sort of full of admiration for the world, and they're full of knowledge about ways of science and all the rest of it. But those things don't really bring us contentment and happiness, because contentment and happiness arise within oneself. They don't arise out there. And to make them arise within oneself, one's got to change oneself internally. And this requires a lot of work. We've got to get down and really work at that hard. I mean, morality, which we were talking about before, that's part of it. And that's often quite a lot of work in that. There's a lot of restraint, a lot of control, a lot of doing without. A lot of criticism from friends who think you should go and do things just the way everyone else does in their sloppy way. And so on, like that. Now, we say if the discontent is caused, if there are causes to it, then it must be possible to stop it. If it wasn't caused, if it was caused by a god or something of that sort, maybe it wouldn't be possible. But if it's caused by ourselves, by our own wrong actions and misunderstanding, then we should be able to do something about it. And in fact, the teaching is that one can come to the cessation of this discontent by getting rid of those defilements in oneself which constantly lead one in the wrong direction, constantly blind one and prevent one seeing. And the way to get rid of these defilements is in fact the ways of first morality, practicing morality, so that one can have a feeling of freedom towards the world. One doesn't feel that one owes any debts, either monetary or otherwise. Secondly, training one's mind so that it becomes stronger, more powerful, more capable, more unified. And the third thing is using that mind to develop wisdom, to search, investigate, and to find out all about oneself, what one is, what one's made of, how one works, and what's wrong, and to get rid of what's wrong, because it's the wisdom which gets rid of the trouble. It's the wisdom which puts things right. But it's no good trying to develop the wisdom without having a basis of calm and concentration. Because otherwise it won't be wisdom, it'll be just discursive thought. Wisdom is something different, much deeper, much more penetrating. Whereas the discursive thought is just on the surface, it flips about without ever going deeply into things. That is, those four factors, the factor of discontent of the cause of it, the cessation of the discontent and the cause of that, is the Four Noble Truths.
Can I just ask you a question on this wisdom? Is it possible for a person who is a layman to develop the calm that will produce the wisdom, such as a monk is able to do?
Yeah. Oh, yes, it can do. I mean, the thing is, you mustn't make such a distinction between monks and lay people. I mean, here we've got human beings. And they take on different modes of life and different rules and so on. Now, insofar as those rules and that mode of life is important, so it makes it more easy to do it as a monk. Because the monk hasn't got the restless activity that the average lay person's got. I mean, we don't, as monks, we don't have to go catching trains or buses, driving cars here and there, go shopping, fighting one's way down the street through crowds of people, and all the rest of it. We don't have to do this. And because we don't have to do this, the environment we're in is naturally more calm, so it's much easier to cool off and to get into oneself. Whereas the layperson has more difficulty in that way. But one can put it roughly like this, I would say. The layperson is not one person, it's a whole range. And there are those lay people who can undoubtedly develop the calm and concentration, and they can develop wisdom while living in their lay life. But they're few and far between. There are some, but not many. There are other lay people who try as they will never do it as a lay person. Because they're too involved in the world, and the world takes hold of them, and they can't stop themselves, they can't control themselves. But between that, there are people who can develop, but much more slowly as a lay person. As a layperson, to try and really see the way and to cure oneself is not easy. As they say, what are the world takes all. The world sort of grabs everything of the person. It takes their body, their interests, their mind and their heart, until really they've got nothing left.
You mentioned before for laymen the five precepts to practice. Do you have any suggestions as far as a meditation practice for a layman who is involved in the world, who wants to calm his mind and be able to better live in the world and also at the same time develop himself as a Buddhist?
Yeah, but the first thing is that they should realize the importance of morality. This is very, very much the first thing they have to do. Because without that, the meditation practice is likely to go wrong. They may get results from it, but the results won't be the right results. So there must be some basis of morality. To think that one can just do the meditation, as some people teach nowadays, you can do the meditation without having morality. Morality doesn't matter. This is real nonsense. It means they haven't understood morality. They don't know what it means. You've got to have a basis of morality. At least one should be practicing moral way of life. Even if one's been bad in the past in that direction. What one's done in the past doesn't suddenly disappear. It may take quite a long time before the effects of what one's done will wear off. But you've got to be at least practicing a moral way of life in the present. Now, with that as the basis, then one can do techniques for developing calm. Probably the best one for most people in the West is to just sit down quietly. One doesn't have to sit cross-legged, but if it's comfortable and you can do it so well and good, that's the best way. Sit in a chair. Shouldn't be too comfortable and too soft. Not the sort of chair that inclines him to go to sleep. It's best to sit somewhat upright without being too tense. And then one puts one's attention on one's breathing. Putting one's attention on one's breathing doesn't mean that one tries to breathe more deeply or to modify it. You don't. You're just watching. By watching, it's really more feeling. You feel it. Feel it going in and out. Normally at the nostrils, at the tip of the nostril, or anywhere sort of, at the nostrils, you can use. And one should put one's attention on it where one feels it most strongly. And then you just keep your attention on the breath there, noticing it going in and out like that. And try and keep your attention just on that. The first thing that people find is that their attention remains on it for about maybe half a minute if they can concentrate well. Mostly about 15 seconds. And their minds jumped away to something else. And it can be away for 10, 20 minutes before they realize they're meant to be sitting doing meditation practice. They go bring it back. Now, the thing lacking here is what we call mindfulness. Mindfulness means keeping one's mind in the present. It means I've heard called presence of mind. One doesn't go daydreaming, wandering, thinking about this, not thinking about that, all over the place all the time. But one keeps one's mind right here and now. One keeps it in the meditation practice on the breath. The breath is the anchor. One mustn't think that there's anything very special in the breath here. Breath is merely a device. It's merely just a convenient thing to put your attention on, to hold the attention there. Later, as the meditation progresses and develops, the breathing can be dropped, but usually it's quite a long time before that happens. Now,
can I just stop it for a minute and turn this?
Yeah.
It's probably
how much is this thing?
Goodbye. Oh. We've begun 30 minutes.
You know, the thing is, some people may find with this meditation practice that they get results quite quickly. There are a few who do. Most people, it's a hard slog for quite a long time. There are some who do get results quite quickly. And they find that they get absorbed, and often they see things, images, maybe hear sounds. All sorts of things can happen. Now, if a person is of such a type that they get these things coming up, then they should see that all these things are distractions. It may be very intriguing to try and follow these things. To follow, if you see images, you may see images of your street or houses or people or things like that. These are just things one's seen in the day, and they're coming up into one's mind. Then again, it's possible some people may see things more deep. They may see things like the gods or the angels or things of that sort. This is possible. But to begin with, one must not have anything to do with any of them. These are realms in which a person can go into once they have skill. Once they know what they're doing, once their mindfulness is really strong. But until it's strong, they mustn't go playing in that field. It's dangerous. But provided they keep onto the breathing, or they keep within the body, their own body, keep their attention within the body, the meditation practice is pretty safe. Danger can come if they let their mind go wandering outside. When one becomes concentrated, there can be danger in this. But if you keep it inside, there's no danger.
Can I ask a question about, for a layperson who is involved in the world and his mind is very very active and thinking about different things and worrying about things and planning things, how this person might cut that off, let go of that, and relax without you know, being preoccupied with it when sits down in meditation.
Well, it's very difficult because when you start the flywheel going, it won't just suddenly stop. It goes on. I mean, it's like that with the world. It doesn't suddenly stop. It goes on. Because of that, it's only by training that one can learn to drop it, drop these things. I mean, there are methods of dropping. But and I mean, I could tell you, but I don't know if it would be much use, because a person who's not trained themselves in these ways, they can't easily do it. I mean, one way is to stop words. Most of one's thinking is kept going by words. That's a sort of dialogue within oneself, speech going on the whole time. And one way is to block these words, don't let them come off. But I mean, unless one's trained oneself to do this, most people can't do it. If you block those words, then the thoughts they won't die away suddenly. But if you keep them blocked, they'll die down, and calm down gradually. This is one way. The other way is, in fact, to put one's attention as firmly as one can on the breathing. It's probably the best way for most people. And if they do that, they'll find that the breath becomes sort of like a friend. Any time when they're free, and they don't have to think about anything particular, or waiting for a train, or whatever they wait for in America, then they put their attention on the breath, and they can calm down. And they find that this is very beneficial. They find that this helps them a great deal. But whatever one does, whatever method one tries or uses to try and overcome these thoughts, one mustn't think that it's easy. It isn't. Control of mind is very difficult. But the more one trains oneself, the more one learns mindfulness particularly, presence of mind, keeping oneself in the present, not allowing mind just to go wandering as it likes anyway. This is the real thing. And generally speaking, if people get no success at meditation practice, it's simply because there isn't enough mindfulness. That's the thing that's lacking nearly every time.
There's another contemplation that people in the West sometimes feel is morbid, and that's a contemplation of death. To show us that we are impermanent. Perhaps you could say something about the purpose of the contemplation of death and how to do it, because I found in the past with my practice, when I was a monk, I practiced this, and yet it didn't ever seem to really get through to the heart. And now that I'm 45 years old, I have a much better feeling for the fact that my life is impermanent and, in fact, short. How might one? What is the purpose of contemplation of death, and how might one practice it?
The people in the world generally have the idea that they're going to live forever. They act as though they're going to live forever. They act in careless ways, flippant ways, as though they've got all the time in the world to play about. Now, if one contemplates death, one can realize that one hasn't got all the time in the world. But in fact, time is short. I wonder if I better get doing something. And this can be something very important to give one a sense of urgency. Again, if you contemplate death, your mind tends to wander far less, and to wander about and to sort of think of all sorts of other things far less. Because if you realize that death may come at any moment. One can't be sure that one's not going to die within the next 10 seconds. And if a person can live like this, they won't go hankering after things in the future, because they know that the future is very uncertain. Because they don't hanker after things, there isn't the craving. When there's not the craving, one's not creating the discontent at all. Because that the contemplation of death can cut down discontent.
I think we were talking about the contemplation of death.
Oh yeah. One thing though about contemplation of death, books always say that this is the most suitable contemplation for a person who's quite intellectual. The very intellectual person, the person who likes to reason a lot and think about things and sort of university type. Now, I would say it's suitable for other people as well, and it's a very good thing to contemplate death. But the contemplation of death as a meditation practice is mainly suitable for the intellectual person.
Can you suggest an approach to the contemplation of death, a method of doing it, how one gets started, what one thinks about?
Well, I mean, what does it mean? When you come to the time of death, what is your experience going to be? Try and visualize it, try and think. Then think, this body, this goes. With this body going, all sensation goes. Sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch. So one's perception of the world, as one knows it, all disappears. One's memory would presumably go, or a lot of it anyway. One's possessions will all go completely. One won't have control over the slightest part of it. One's on one's own, then. Now, one's got to think about this and think, well, what does it mean? Why do I put so much importance in my possessions? Why am I so concerned about what other people think of me? Why am I so concerned about my social position, my position in my job, all these things? If one's well aware of death, if one contemplates death a lot, and becomes so if one feels it and sees it clearly, the importance of these things tends to die away. Because of that, when they change and become something that most people would not like, then one's not affected by it in the same way. I mean, for example, one's money. Supposing one's managed to make a lot of money. If one contemplates death, one realizes, well, this money, I can't take even the tiniest little bit of it with me when I die. It all goes. Goes to someone else. It's not mine. Really, it's hardly mine now. I use it. It's not, to call it mine is not very suitable, really. Because first of all, it's sort of a purely conventional thing in society. It isn't something that I can just do with as I like. I can only do with it as I like within certain very definite limits. Then when I die, I won't even have that much control. A whole lot goes to someone else. Now, supposing that person, when they've thought like this enough, they really feel that their money isn't so important. Then, if for some reason they lose their money, it's stolen, or the financial situation changes and they lose it, then it doesn't come so hard on them. They don't feel it so bad. Because if they didn't think of it as belonging to them, or as being sort of an indispensable possession, if it goes, well, they don't see it as something that they've personally lost. And because of this, there's less discontent, less suffering. That person's much happier. As to saying that the contemplation of death is morbid, it's pretty tautologous, really. What does morbid mean? Concerned with death, doesn't it? Say it's morbid, obviously, is correct, but I mean, it doesn't really mean very much to say it's morbid.
The Buddhist concept of death is that we die, but our mind doesn't really die, and we are reborn. How does this fit in with the contemplation of death? In what respect do we actually die, and what respect?
No, the citta is something that's very difficult to understand. It's rather like this, to give an idea of what it means. We see, hear, smell, taste, and touch things. But how do you know things? What is this knowing? When you know something, supposing you see something and you know perfectly well that that's such and such an object, and you know its purpose and so on, how do you know you're not deceived? There's something in you which knows. Now, when you ask, what is this that knows, it's very difficult to catch hold of. In fact, this knowing is a quality of the citta. It's the one that knows. But the knowing is not also a sensation. When you know something, it's not a sensation. Because the sensation is the thing you know. In other words, you see something and you define that thing as such and such an object. And you know that that's the correct definition of that thing. But the knowing isn't itself an object at all. You can't find it. Can't find it as anything in seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. But knowing is something that the citta does. I don't know if there's much point in going more into the ways of the citta at the moment. It would take really too long It would take really too long until I think not really practical for people in the West to get too concerned about it to begin with.
I have a question on another type of practice which people also consider rather strange, and that's the contemplation of the body. Could you say something about the purpose of the contemplation of the body and an approach to it?
Contemplation of the body is very important. Here again we come back to, well, people know all about the world. You know, they've gone into science, and if you ask them the reason for doing this in science or doing that or the way something works, they can go into great detail. Even if they don't themselves know, they can easily find out. They can find somebody who does or point to the right book and so on. But when it comes to themselves, what do they know? Even if they know physiology, in the medical sense, all they're doing is considering somebody else's body or just a body in a textbook, not their own. But surely this body is extremely important. If you don't have this body, where's the world? It's only this body that knows the world. But this is a sort of one's outlet into the world, so to speak. And surely, isn't it worth knowing this thing? Knowing what its nature is? I mean, it seems to me that to know the body, to know its nature, is very, very important. And when one knows its nature, one should question to oneself, well, what sort of a thing is it? Is it a very nice thing or not? Now, one doesn't have to have preconceived ideas about it. One can just say, well, is it beautiful or isn't it beautiful? Let's have a look. And most people in the world seem to think it's very beautiful, that it's sort of a most desirable thing and so on. But look at it and see whether it is. What happens if you don't wash it for a few days? You've got to keep washing the thing, otherwise it stinks before long. You've got to feed it with food, which, if you examine the nature of that food, not really very, very nice stuff. I mean, the food you eat, supposing it was smeared all over the outside of your body, would you like it? You put it inside. There's all sorts of things like that you have to look at about this body. See whether it's a nice thing or not, whether it's beautiful or not. We must get to the truth of the matter. And, after all, most people think that they are the body. Well, surely you should know something about yourself. If you know all this about the world, why do you leave out the one thing that's the most important of the lot, yourself? Why not try and get to know yourself? And the first thing is to question the body, because it's the most gross part of oneself. And to question that and to see that the nature of this body is very important. Again, in Buddhism we practice the contemplation of the body with the idea we come to see that this body in fact isn't myself. It comes from this world, it returns to this world, it's part of this world. It's all made of atomic structure, atoms, molecules, all the rest of it, chemicals, and it doesn't go beyond that. It's nothing apart from these things. So one can see, if one looks properly, that this in fact isn't me. It's not myself. It doesn't really even belong to me, because I can't control it completely. I mean, the body is derived from the world, it goes back to the world. I can't stop it going back to the world. If I say, well, I don't want to eat, I'm not going to eat. Well, you can only keep that up for a short while, for most a few weeks. We're sort of constrained to eat. It's almost as though we're in a sort of prison house. This body is like a prison house which keeps us here and keeps us in certain conditions that we're not free from. Now we should see this body and realize that in fact this body is not me, and it's holding me in a situation which may or may not be desirable. And we've got to see what the truth of this matter is. I mean, after all, why not look at the body? Good heavens. Seems to me an obvious thing to look at. We can go a bit further, actually, and say the person who has examined the body and realizes that it's not as himself, if anything happens to his body, he's not concerned, like the person who thinks the body is himself, because he knows that it's not happening to him. He knows that although it's happening to this body, this is not me. Although it's unpleasant, the unpleasantness is the unpleasantness of this body. It's not me that's affected. And the person who can see that and know that, they've got a great strength. And when the body dies, they know that it's not me that dies. So contemplation of the body can show this up and can give one a great deal of moral, emotional strength.
There's one other type of practice that you haven't mentioned, and that's the repetition of the mantra Bhutto. Could you say a little bit about how to practice this?
Yeah, it's not really a mantra at all. It's just a repetition. Mantra's rather something rather different. It is a repetition, and it's used exactly in the same way as the breathing practice, in that you've got an object there which you keep your attention on. In this case, it's a sound object, and it's the Buddha, and you you use the concept of the Buddha to help one. But I'm not so sure how that this is terribly suitable for people in the West. Mainly because we were not brought up as Buddhists when we were children. People who were have got an emotional side to their idea of the Buddha, which in the West most people haven't got. And because they haven't got that, the word Buddha doesn't mean the same thing to them as it would to people in the East who have been Buddhists from birth. But it can be a very good practice. Many have found extremely valuable. But they're mostly Thai people who have done that. Or I suppose Burmese or something like that too.
I noticed that the listening, it's often said that listening to the Dhamma or the Dharma calms one's mind. I noticed that just tonight listening to you talk has a very calming effect. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yes, because the thing that knows the truth within one, the thing which realizes the truth, even though it doesn't realize it in a conscious way, is the heart or the citta. It's the heart in the sense we take it to heart in English. Now, when there's talk on Dhamma, it doesn't rouse one up. It's not disturbing. It cools one down. One appreciates the truth of it. The truth of it is there. And because of that, the tendency is to feel relaxed. Many people, when they listen to a Dhamma talk, they feel like going to sleep. It's almost as though they get absorbed in themselves and they can go into a sort of semi-sleep state. And this is calm coming, this is a state of calm. It's not a wrong thing. If you actually go to sleep, it goes a bit too far. But it is a state of calm.
I don't have any more questions. Do you have any questions? If you're going to say anything more, maybe I ought to put in another tape.
I think I'll probably...
Still, if you don't have any more questions, Sachin, when you have anything else to say? What about you? You should, I thought, Sachin, you... The sort of problem you mentioned to me with your head.
There's a little bit more on there.
This afternoon you mentioned to me that why you...
Could you start that over again? Okay, thank you.
This afternoon you mentioned to me that why he disrobed the last time was because he had a lot of fear. That he kept on having images and experiences in meditation which caused him to be afraid that he was going to go crazy.
That was one of the reasons. I won't say that was the reason. I'm just saying that was one of the factors.
You see, this is part of the trouble people have, that they don't know what drives them crazy. Images don't drive them crazy. Seeing images, hearing things, this is not being crazy. After all, how can it be? I mean, if you see something, you see it. If you hear things, you hear it. But if you believe in Jesus Christ when you're doing that, then that is crazy. It's one's belief, one's thoughts that make one crazy, not the images. Now, even people in schizo states, if they see the strange images some of them do see, if they could realize that this image here is just a product of my mind, it's nothing more, it's just an image, just color, form, nothing very important, they'd jump out of the state straight away. Of course they can't, because I mean they create the images that are suitable to their own state. I mean they can't do that. But the fear of these images There's nothing wrong with the images, but it's the fear that's the trouble. This is where the trouble always comes. And whenever fear comes up, one has to learn to deal with it. There are one or two ways. The best, if you can do it, is face it. Say to hell, I'm not going to give way to this. And whatever the feelings are inside, it continues. Or like Tanachan Chob once. Twice. Tiger came up to him. He came right up quite close to him. And he talked to him. He was saying, why are you coming here? You're frightening me. Like this. And then he walked deliberately straight towards it. The thing leapt away. Now, that's the sort of way to overcome fear. The worst thing one can ever do is to run. You never overcome it. I mean, when one sort of sits in an armchair and listens to a tape of somebody walking towards a tiger, it may seem just rather interesting. But you just picture yourself actually in that situation and realize what it means. I mean, you haven't got the security of a nice warm room, nice chair and all the rest of it. You're out in the jungle. And probably the nearest person 5 miles away. And there are wild animals, not only the tiger there, but others as well around about. And it's maybe at night and it's dark. All you've got is a small lantern, a few candles. Now, it takes some doing that.
You mentioned that there were two ways of dealing with fear. Is there another way?
Well, there's several. Yeah, another way. When fear comes up, you question, what is fear? How do I know I'm afraid? What tells me? And you will find that it's inside yourself, feeling. When you look and you search for that feeling, you want to find exactly where it is. You're not satisfied until you find that feeling inside you, what that fear is. You must know. Because of that, you try and keep it going. To try and find out what it is. And you can't. Fear disappears.
So you're saying you focus on the fear and just look
on the fear itself.
Strictly on the fear itself.
Yes.
On the feeling of fear.
Because from what one's learned, one knows perfectly well that the images or whatever it is that caused the fear is harmless. I mean, if it is a tiger, of course, that may be harmful, but then one has to use other methods. But people who are in the West, in New York, or wherever it is, probably needn't worry about tigers.
Unless they're at the zoo.
Yeah.
Or the circus.
They've got muggers.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah.
They're even worse than tigers.
They don't run away so easily. Mm. Is there any other approach to dealing with fear?
Yes, the other way is to go on doing just what everyone's been doing. In other words, if you're walking Chong Kong, for instance, you just go on walking, regardless of the fear. If you're doing a meditation practice, you go on doing it, whatever the meditation practice is, regardless of the fear. And you take no notice of it at all. Keep your attention on what you're doing. Another method. The method given in the suttas is to recall the Buddha, or the Dhamma, the Sangha. Now, unless one has faith in the Buddha, of course that's not likely to be effective. But this can be very effective to the person who has. There are many ways of dealing with fear. But the thing one has to realize is sometimes a fear will arise internally. When it arises internally, then you search for something to call a cause of that fear. In other words, fear starts arising, you think, what's happened? Why am I afraid like this? You look for a cause of it. Now the thing is, what in fact has happened is probably due to one's meditation practice, changes have taken place internally, and it gives rise to that experience which one calls fear. And there's no external object at all that's causing it. It's merely just a change of state internally. And because of that, one's fear is merely a feeling, merely a situation that's arisen. And it's not because of any object that is threatening or anything of that sort. And this one's got to realize, I mean, one's got to, that if one finds fear coming up, when a quick look around tells one there's no object there that I can see, then one should realize this is just a change of state internally. Can get a lot of fear coming up that way, quite strongly. There is one other thing which is allied to fear, which is very important, I think, and that is in the world. One sometimes has situations arising. One has to do things one doesn't like doing. Whether it's one's duty, or one's in the situation to do it, or whatever it is anyway. I mean, maybe you're in a position you have to tell somebody that they're sacked from their work. You don't like doing it. It's your duty to tell them. You haven't sacked them, somebody else has, but it's your duty to tell them. You've got to go and tell them. Now, the thing is to realize that whenever this happens, one must always go and do it. One must never shirk it. One should never get somebody else to do it. Because if one gets somebody else to do it, one's giving way, and that's very bad training for oneself. I should always do it myself. I look on it as an important part of one's training. It's very important as strengthening character. It overcomes weakness very well. It's very important for overcoming weakness in oneself.
I get a lot of situations like that as a probation officer where I have to tell a probationer that he has to do something, has to go to a program or something, or else I have to tell him that he's going back to court and may possibly go to jail, and they sometimes get very angry, and it's sometimes a difficult task to do.
Yeah, yes. But it's very important that one should. And you should look on this as being training for yourself. Because if you will look, you'll find that there's something in yourself you've got to overcome, some reluctance. Now you have to ask yourself, what is that reluctance in yourself? Or we can put it another way, why is that reluctance there? What is it that produces this reluctance? But I mean, to be in a situation like that, you shouldn't look on it as being very bad or anything, that's all. It's very good. And if you do that and do it properly every time, regardless of what the other person thinks or feels or says or anything like that, you gain from it.
It's almost facing fear in a situation like that is almost like facing it in meditation. It's just that meditation is a little more, I guess, more immediate or more concentrated, or would you say?
Yeah, the thing is that when you have to do that with someone else, the fear that comes up is usually the fear of hurting oneself.
Of hurting oneself or being hurt oneself?
No, hurting yourself because you identify with the person. I mean, we think that other people are human beings and people in the same way that we are. And in a sense, they are. What we have to realize is that the view we have of ourselves is a false view anyway. So the view we have of other people is false also. And because of that, what we think of as other people is something false, not true. What we see out there is not really other people. What the true person is something very different from what we think it is and see. What we look out for in other people is usually a personality, a character. And all these things are just false, they're imposters. They're not the real person at all. The real person is much more like the child they were when they were very young. It's much nearer to them. But the one that we see is just little trappings hung on, like a sort of decorated suit of clothes. Oh, we're the same thing ourselves. Don't know what we do with that. This is where the kilesas, the defilements. Very important, the kilesas. Because they're the ones that cause all the trouble. And you should come to know them. And I have to see that the person is always under the influence of the kilesas. The only time when they're not is when they're deep asleep. The kilesas never leave them any peace. They never have any...
Just stop for a moment, and I'd just like to ask you, if I'm sure this is stopped, put in another tape, and maybe you could say a little more about kilesa.
Yes, they are important, actually.
Jim, recording on this other tape.
Oh.
Which I'm going to give you. But.
Oh, okay. Perhaps you could... Could you say something about the kilesa or the defilements, what they are? And
well, the kilesas... Fundamentally, the basis of the kilesa is a greed, hate, and delusion. But it goes into a whole myriad of things from there, like envy, stinginess, worry, conceit, vanity, pride, and all sorts of more subtle ones as well. So, the all the wrong things. But the kilesas also involve completely wrong views. Come under the heading of delusion. You see, in Buddhism we say the whole world is samut, as they say. Samut means supposition. We suppose everything. We suppose that the world's like this. We suppose that people are like that. We suppose that things are all the time. Everybody's supposing the whole time. And when you look at the views and the opinions that people have, the whole lot are just that they suppose it's like this. Even science is doing supposing the whole time. although they do it in a more orderly way as well. But what the truth really is, people are not concerned with. All they have is these sort of suppositions the whole time. In other words, the whole world is relative. There's no fixed basis, there's no sort of underlying groundwork which is real solid and real. And because of that, the outlook on the world, the outlook on other people, the whole outlook we have is all distorted. And it's kinesis that does this. They stem from how we are, ignorance. But the thing to realize is that kinesis are always there. In all except the Arahant. They're there the whole time. In fact, we're practically made up of kilesas. What one thinks of as oneself is, well, it's really, it comes from the kilesas. And it's an imposter. It's quite false. What one truly is a very different thing. Something that one doesn't recognize as self. Because of that, in Buddhism, we teach anatta, that there's no self in other words. Because everything that we recognize as self is an imposter. Everything we feel is self and think of as self. And when people have these kilesas and they have wrong view, and they look on the world in completely wrong ways, look on themselves in completely wrong ways, they get wrong ideas of what they are, what the world is, what their purpose is, what they should be doing, then you get views, purposes, and the ways of people which are antagonistic to one another. Because they're based on these kilesas, which are defilements. So you get selfish views. And self-interest, and self-orientated action. When you get that, you get two people with selfish views and self-orientated action and so on, and they don't harmonize, then you get trouble. And, well, just look in the paper and see what happens. All the time, these kilesas, just these. This is the whole trouble in the world. Without these kilesas, there wouldn't be any trouble. A lot of all the sort of talk, armaments talk with the Russians, the whole lot, the troubles in Afghanistan, the troubles everywhere in the world, just kilesas, the whole lot. And the thing that causes it, these kilesas in people. They're very important indeed. In fact, the only way of sorting out the troubles in the world is really for each individual to get down to try and cure his kilesas, at least to some extent. But what's the world doing? It's going in the opposite direction. It's increasing them the whole time. It's broadcasting it on television and radio a lot. I mean, everybody is being prodded into increasing their greed to buy more products. You know, the advertising, you need this product, whatever it is. They advertising, they do it on television, they do it in newspapers, radio, a lot. And these are just promoting these kilesas. And when they promote these kilesas, they're promoting the discontent in people. In fact, advertisers make discontent so that people will buy things, try and gain back their contentment. I mean, I don't blame the advertisers. They're also in the same boat. They're discontented also because they can't sell enough. They never can sell them. However much they sold, it wouldn't be enough. This is a way of greed. the whole world's being taught greed the whole time. It wasn't like this at one time, as it is now. One time money wasn't important like it is now, but money has taken over. Till now it's dragging the whole world down. And it's interesting to think out here in the villages. It seems when Tanachan was young, he said people didn't worry about money. There wasn't much use for it. If you went into a door and you'd perhaps buy something, but then you had to walk 10 or 15 miles through jungle. That was dangerous. So he didn't really have all that much use for money. And as far as rice was concerned, people planted and grew enough rice for their own use, and perhaps had a little bit more just to sell, to make a little bit of money. They weren't interested in making much money. But really now, I mean, they all want their Honda motorbikes and their television sets, colour television too, and stereo sets too.
I was very surprised when I went back to my Peace Corps village, the contrast of old with new, old huts with television antennas sprouting from them, and color TV sets in just about every other house, and automobiles in the village. When I first went there in almost 20 years ago, there was no television, there was hardly any electricity, there were no automobiles, no motorcycles even, no refrigerators. Now they have all these. They even have a water supply system. They used to hot nom. That's sort of a cultural thing that's taken away from them now. They don't hot nom, carry water over their shoulders anymore. Mm-hmm. And they even have a bridge into the village, which they didn't have before, and a road all the way through going to Mukdahan. Mm. It's amazing how rapidly it's changing here.
Well, this is what's called progress, you see. But they're progressing externally, and they're regressing internally. Because the more they have of these things, the more they have of greed, the more they want. Which they didn't have before. Not in the same way. They had a degree of contentment at one time. It's rapidly disappearing. You know, the world's in a very sorry mess. And I'm afraid the balance sheet of science is quite heavy on the side of causing more discontent, more trouble than it is on the other side. And one of the things that's been very important is the what you might almost call a failure of religion. 1,200 years ago, Christianity was still quite strong in the West. People were quite controlled by it. Although they didn't know much about the practices of it, they were still legacy from the past, and they were quite well controlled. And now, it's hard to find what Christianity is in the West now. It's so fragmented, all sorts of bits and pieces, and the teaching is hard to find now. It's hard to find anything that's genuine. It's been all sort of messed about the whole time. And people have gradually dropped away from it. Because they dropped away from it, they no longer see any reason for morals. This was partly, I think, a wrong teaching of Christianity, in that the reason for morals were usually placed on the necessity of placating God. which is a false reason for morality. Because to the false reason for morality, people very easily turned against him, because there wasn't really good cause and effect in it. I'm not going to blame the original Christianity here, because what that taught about morality, I don't know. I think they had something far deeper. But the surface Christianity that took over in the West, or that gradually developed in the West, had some very wrong teachings in it.
In other words, they don't teach one to be responsible for their own cause and effect. They try to project it onto an external being. Is that correct?
To quite a large extent, yes. Actually, it's very difficult to get any true concept of what they do think. It seems to me that they say that each person is given responsibility by God. Yet God is all powerful. And there's a contradiction here. If God is all powerful, then people have no power unless they're God. Because how can you have something that's all powerful and yet you've got a power separate from it? If this is a power separate from that, then it's not all powerful. So I mean, there are contradictions like that, which I don't know, there's not much point in really going into them and trying to clarify them, because as far as I'm concerned, I'd rather turn away from their ways. But at the same time, it's quite remarkable how many good people did develop in Christianity. How many did develop good people in many ways. Also, I mean, the teaching of God. The way it's put in the creeds and in the technical dogma of the churches is a bit hard to defend. But there are ways in which one can see that the word God can have a meaning. It's quite genuine and quite good.
Something that I've gotten since I've been here, I think, is kind of a fear of what I might be doing to myself by wrong actions, and a fear of not practicing strenuously the path of Buddhism, the morality and the meditation practice. It seems that this is what we seem to be lacking in the West. There's maybe a fear of perhaps an external God, but a real fear of our own actions and the results of our own actions. To a large extent, we're really seem to be lacking in that.
Of course, when one talks about the West, one's talking about a giant phenomena with millions of people. And one can't cover that with any one sort of view at all, obviously. But there are certainly, in one way you get the Christian phenomenon, the people who adhere to Christianity, and some of their views seem to be a bit doubtful. I'm not sure that matters all that much, it leads them to be good people. Sometimes I'm afraid it doesn't, in some sects anyway. But if it leads them to be good people and to act well, then I don't think it matters all that.
Also, of course, part of the problem is the fact that religion is not that influential with so many people.
Yeah, it's not. And the other thing that you get in the West is the people who are not religious, and usually what you've got there is a conceit. And they're conceited. They often have the conceit of science, or the conceit that they are well in control of their world, and that although they may not know all about science, that they have a full confidence that that will, that explains everything, or it will in time, you know. And it's only when these people start getting older, and the idea, the realization comes that one day they're going to die, that this gets shaken. The trouble is, when it does get shaken, they're too set in their ways to do much. And very few of them can really then sort of turn and get down, really.